Okay. Peter, mm-hmm. What is your idea of perfect happiness?
Perfect happiness? Ooh, that's a deep question to start off the podcast.
Isn't it?
Perfect happiness. See, I don't think that it exists. I'm terrible for this game. Like, perfect.
That's an answer.
I mean, hold on. I don't want to disappoint you because you put a lot of this was your intro here.
Wow.
And I know you take great pride in these, so.
Just see where this is going. It's not.
No.
It's not what you think it is.
It's not. Oh, you're going to trick me?
Just keep going.
I don't know if there's. The perfect part's throwing me.
Your idea of it.
Dark brew of coffee. Strong.
Okay.
Morning. Quiet. Just kind of putzing around.
Nice.
I love it.
Slippers?
Maybe a good wool sock. Time of year. Let's see here. Fall. Fall's nice.
Yeah.
A little chill in the air. I like that. Yeah, there we go. Okay.
Good. That's perfectly acceptable. That's okay, good. Acceptable. What is your greatest fear?
Oh, boy. Greatest fear. Well, I've always hated heights. I don't know if that's my greatest fear. Well, maybe something height related. I'm giving you some thought here, so don't rush me here. Greatest fear. For a while, and I haven't had this fear in a long time, that I would be getting into my car and somebody would drive by and shoot me. But that was a very irrational fear. Yeah. That was about, I was like in my early 20s, I was like, man, every time I open my car, I don't know. I just had that fear. That was kind of like a unusual fear. But I would say something heights related. I don't like heights bother me.
Being forced to bungee jump.
That sounds terrible. Jumping out of a plane, I think, would kind of like almost ruin my life in a way. Like, I don't know if
being forced to jump out of a plane, being forced to by people who tell you, hey, there's only 50-50 chance this parachute's going to work, and they shove you out.
Well, I mean, that sounds terrible. Like, who would like that?
50-50.
So wait.
Skydiving itself would be horrifying, I think.
Why is that the scenario?
I'm just trying to create a scenario for you.
Okay, 50-50, I'm in a plane. I mean, I have no choice in this, so yeah, I guess.
Let's say it's just supposed to be extra scary. A situation that would be extra scary.
Yeah, I mean, that's scary.
Which living person do you most admire?
What living person do I most admire?
Yeah.
Like George Clooney?
Yeah.
I was trying to do a joking one, but yeah.
That's a good one.
I'm trying to bring some humor to this because I think I feel like I might get sucked into a serious trap with you.
What is your greatest extravagance?
Greatest extravagance? Maybe books? extravagance. Probably, I like to get a good quality beer. Spend a little extra on the beer.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not going, you know.
German stuff.
Yeah, I like to get some of the German stuff. I like to get, some of the rare stuff occasionally. Not all the time, but I would say that's some extravagance.
Books and beer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very Colorado type thing.
Very plaid shirt.
What do you consider the most overrated virtue?
Overrated virtue. I always think it's silly when people are like, I have to, like that whole mantra, this isn't a virtue, this is a tangent, where it's like, I think everyone's obsessed with working at a job that is like fun to do, and it is like, I never worked a day in my life when I, you know, teach surfing or whatever. I'm like, for society to exist, some people have to do crappy jobs and not like it.
Yeah, we can't all do that. But pick something you love and you'll never work a day in your life.
I'm like, that can grind society to a halt.
Tell that to the janitor.
Yeah.
Or house workers or whatever. Yeah.
Plumber or the guy who's laying concrete or something, or or even the person who's like working at a call center, tell them that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't like that. I think that I hate that. That's a hot take probably, but I don't like that saying. I think it should go away.
No, I like it. That's a good answer.
Okay.
That's a good answer. This is a 35-question this is a 35-question questionnaire.
Is this a good podcast? Are we going to gain 35 questions.
We're not going to do them all. It was just a sampling.
I think I opened up quite a bit to you.
Yeah.
Now, what career should I do after answering these questions?
Well, let's see. What is your favorite occupation? Is one of them.
I don't know.
Who are your favorite writers? Okay. Who is your hero of fiction?
I don't have a hero.
Do this last one, and then we'll get into what this is.
Okay.
Which historical figure do you most identify with?
Historical figure do I most identify with? Does that be like a famous person? Is that what it's going?
Historical figure.
Historical figure.
Anyone from your grandpa to Abe Lincoln to Mother Teresa?
The big trifecta. Side note.
Doubting Thomas.
Who?
Doubting Thomas, Jesus's disciple.
You're a lot more resurrected. I have no idea. Who do I look up to? Someone nervous. Someone
Julius Caesar. Woody Allen.
Julius Caesar. I'll say Julius Caesar. Is that bad?
This is Julius Caesar. You're both conquerors.
We're both just a couple of guys. Just I don't know.
You're better than Caesar.
Let me think about this. Hold on. Paul Simon. There we go.
Hey. Yeah. Both folk heroes.
I know.
Okay. So these are from the Proust questionnaire.
Oh.
It's in the back of Vanity Fair magazine. Yeah. Celebrities, these things. It was popularized but not invented by Marcel Proust.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to be like a fun, like a parlor game type thing, but it'll actually give you psychological insight into people if they answer honestly.
Yeah.
So I always thought that was kind of cool. But for whatever reason, I had it in my head that the question Hamlet or Midsummer Night's Dream was on this questionnaire. Turns out I was thinking of a different, I think it was the Paris Review or the New Statesman. Another magazine would ask people that.
Yeah.
But I had it in my head, okay, this is going to be my intro. And then a week ago when I was looking into it, I was like, oh crap, different questionnaire. But I still wanted to open with the questionnaire. So, and it got me thinking.
Okay.
Whose questionnaire was invented in like the 1890s?
It's very, yes.
It's time for a modern, updated
question. We want to update the questionnaire?
That's even more psychologically astute. So I started one of our own.
I want to hear it. I'm excited.
I don't have a whole, it'll be
legal pad. Okay.
35 questions. Ours will be 36.
How much? Bruce, man, 35 questions at like a part, that's a lot. Like, you got to be pretty invested in to be like, I want to hang out, Bruce.
We could do a whole podcast of just we ask each other maybe we can post it online. We can do it on the Patreon. We'll each answer because it's like a written thing.
Okay.
In Vanity Fair. You think it out. It's kind of cool. It's kind of neat. But ours, I started. I haven't finished it. But tell me, these are kind of our.
These are a little first draft, second draft, kind of like it's just in the preliminary phase. Okay. I'm ready.
Would you like to live in a railroad car?
Ooh, okay. You could have given me a million guesses and I would not have started there. Like the Boxcar Children, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hobo. Or you could do it up nice. It's open-ended, you know?
I'm surprised, you know, how the people transform, you know, their, what are they called? Scooter vans? That's not right.
Scooter vans. There's the tiny home phenomenon.
Why haven't they, it must be that they're hard to come by. And they're not, but yeah.
Didn't we have a mutual friend who kind of lived in a railroad car from back in the day? Or was that a box?
That was a friend of his, and he lived
in
a normal apartment, but he built a wooden box inside of his apartment room. So that when you entered, I saw it, there was a wooden door, there was a wooden, like, yeah, there's just a piece of wood, and then there was, like, a door built in. So he had built a room inside a room.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds pretty crazy when you say it out loud on a podcast, but...
It was cool.
I don't know.
I don't know why I had it in my head that it was a railroad car.
How would he get a railroad car in an apartment building?
I thought it was a house that he built around it.
Oh, I see.
Either way, I could live in a railroad car. You do it up nice.
Yeah. Anything. Yeah.
That's just one question of our many.
That's just the one question?
I'm going to put you down as a yes.
Yeah, I'm going to put... How about this? Every once in a while, every couple episodes, you throw out another question.
Yeah, I'm gonna build it up to 36, 37 questions. Price is Right.
Have you run any of these by your wife at all? Do you think she would be into?
Not yet.
Maybe.
I'll test them out on her. Have you ever peed in public?
I don't know. Peed on a golf course. It's kind of public. But I was in the, like, you go into, like, the trees.
You made a point to be discreet. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't just, like, out in the, like, when you say public, what do you mean by public?
Like, I kind of mean that. I don't mean, like, in a concert, just in the middle of.
Okay. So I was like,
the most public place. So that's. That maybe what's the most public place you've ever, and a golf course is like a perfect.
Okay. Yeah, outside. Yeah, on a golf
course. Okay, golf course. Mine's a swimming pool. How are you doing?
Good. That's a question.
That's a question. How are you doing? Would you like to have a sandwich and why?
I think I'm 85% of the time I'm yes, willing to have a sandwich. Yes. Why? There's just a lot of variety and a lot of good textures.
It's a good option for dinner.
There's a lot of ways you can go, the bread variety and what you can do with that.
It's almost infinite.
It's almost infinite.
I think Confucius said no two sandwiches are ever alike.
I think that was the first thing he said.
No man ever eats the same sandwich twice.
I think we should do a whole episode on sandwiches, because how old are sandwiches? I'm going to Google this while you're...
The Earl of Sandwich invented them, and that's where it gets the name.
Is it?
Yeah. You never heard that? The Earl of Sandwich, because he needed something to do with this bread.
Okay.
And he stuck stuff between bread.
Oh, man. Okay, 1762.
Yeah. See, that's not that long.
Actually, no. Hold on here.
It's only a couple years older than America.
One person now... This is from 110 BC.
Mm-hmm.
This person suggested eating bitter herbs inside unleavened matzo bread. Which I guess you can consider a sandwich.
I mean, I think for our purposes, we're going to have to say it's got to be bread. I mean, surely somebody had technically done like a meat sandwich or
someone
something.
Someone says seven. I'm kind of surprised we stumbled on bread or on sandwiches so late. 1762 is a date I'm seeing also.
Maybe that's the Earl of Sandwich. And I think that's where it got started. Surely somebody put stuff between bread before then, but I think it's just when it gets going.
All right.
So that's neat.
You know, we're coming up. This intro is, I don't know, I'm guessing 15 minutes, coming up on 15 minutes.
Last question for our question here.
Gotcha.
Fried eggs on a burger. Load them up or get out of here.
I've never had it, but I want to say load them up.
Load them up.
Sounds fun.
Load them up.
You know, you and I differ on the food stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
That's not too weird. I've seen it at restaurants and stuff.
Like I see
a Cowboy Burger or something.
Diner drives, dinner drives, and haircuts.
A fried egg on there with everything else. You got to eat it with a fork. It's so much stuff. It's not practical.
Is it wrong that I kind of enjoy eating a hamburger with a knife and fork?
No. Okay. It's fitting. I could see that about you. But no, sometimes you got to, especially if it's a big burger.
And on that note. Welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books, questionnaires, and burgers. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. I enjoy what you did there. I think we learned a lot about each other. The audience learned about us.
We should fill out the Proust questionnaire posted somewhere.
I think we should read Proust and see if we can judge him by...
We should.
Yeah. It's one of our gaps in our reading. Matt, tonight we read probably the most famous author,
at least in English, of all time.
Mr. Shakespeare. We might get into this. I don't know. The authorship of Shakespeare. I know that's a thing.
That'd be a fun separate episode.
I think that's something you want to get into, but for our purposes tonight, William Shakespeare is our author. And we read A Midsummer Night's Dream. I want to preface something here.
Okay.
I think I nominated this book, if I'm not mistaken. I might be mistaken on that. Did you nominate or did not?
I think I did.
Okay.
Because it was from July when we did all the slim volumes.
Okay.
We're going to do something slim and fast. It's November.
Months ago, we picked this book. Okay. I'm a strong believer in how you read something and what mindset you read something can affect how you like it. Do you agree?
Yeah.
Okay.
100%.
Yeah. I've been like, I just crammed a bunch of books on my TBR from the podcast. And then I wanted to do some stuff I haven't told you this, but I want to do like a holiday thing over on the Patreon. Like, hey, here's some books coming out recently, holiday wish list, fiction, that kind of stuff. So I've been reading all these side books too. Okay. And I think you know that too, but I want to do, so I'm fitting in the Shakespeare, right? And for whatever reason, this play kind of struck me as silly. Okay. I'm going to also preface it by saying, I know that's a wrong reading of this. Okay. So I want to get this all out before we get into the play in itself and all this kind of stuff. Because I read this play in college. I had a great college course, Shakespeare, I think one or two. I don't know. I read this play. What's funny is the notes I made, I have the same copy that I did then. I didn't understand the notes I made. So I think that either means A, I didn't know what I was talking about when I was 21, or B, I've gotten dumber. Okay.
Or I'm C, sort of both.
Both. Oh man, I didn't even think about C. I think it might be C. That's the most depressing one. Anyway. And I like parts of the play. Mm. But the ending was strange.
Yeah.
It was not what I remember. I remember like, I think three quarters of it. And then when they're like, all right, let's end on the play that these kind of.
Okay, terrible, the play within the play.
Terrible actors are doing. And then people are like criticizing them. And that's how the play. And then like, oh, was this a dream? It's not my favorite Shakespeare. Okay. All that said. Having said all that, I'm coming at this kind of from like an amateur viewpoint, I want to say, because there's like, 400 years, 300 years of scholarship on this play. So obviously there's a lot of meat on here.
Yeah.
But on a person who has got a busy schedule, busy life or whatever, to try and read the play, I was kind of left, not disappointed, but kind of lukewarm, I guess. So that's where I'm coming from. I know we're not usually very critical on this podcast. Positive.
I think Shakespeare can handle it.
But I feel weird saying I'm criticizing Shakespeare. Okay.
So you are not alone.
Okay.
In that opinion. So we'll get into that. But first, I just want so the question, which I think we'll appropriate from, I guess it might be the New Statesman. It's from somewhere that's behind a paywall now, but they used to ask people on their questionnaire, Hamlet or Midsummer Night's Dream. So for you.
Yeah, it'd be Hamlet.
Hamlet.
I think I just like, I don't know, that when you say something like, oh, you often hear this, right? The audience at the time would have gotten all these things, right? That Shakespeare was doing, right? Where he, the wordplay and just sort of, there's a lot of depth to it. And that's what I liked about the college course, because the teacher could kind of fill you in where like, okay, this is what this is coming in and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think it's wrong to say like you lose something over those 400 years, right? Yeah. And it's no fault of Shakespeare, obviously. And it's no fault of like the reader now, maybe. Maybe it is. I'm willing to blame myself. I
think it does come off as kind of a silly play. And one of the things that I ran across, I read the same guy, René Girard, the French guy, who I read his essays on Stendhal for our Stendhal episode, and it helped me kind of make sense of that. He wrote a whole book called A Theater of Envy about Shakespeare. And I just read the Midsummer Night's Dream chapters, but there's like five or six chapters on Midsummer Night's Dream. And it really gave me a foothold onto this play. And I think there's something to it. And that most of the episode is going to be me kind of pointing out certain things about it.
Well, I want to hear that. Because I know, I clearly in the back of my head, I'm like, you are missing stuff. You're reading this while you're reading all these other stuff. You're not giving it your academic brain.
But. Well, Girard's reading, he seems to think everybody else has missed it too. Hmm. And the Hamlet or Midsummer Night's Dream question, it would kind of, that question was meant to sort of people into are serious or kind of fun-loving, silly. That's kind of the breakdown. And I was always a Midsummer Night's Dream person because I had read it before and I thought it was just kind of fun. I'm excited to run them by you because I think Gerard's got some points that make it interesting. I think Shakespeare's digging at something a little deeper. He's on to something. But Girard starts the first essay on Midsummer Night's Dream. I'll quote it here. It's worth quoting at length here. But this is Girard. A Midsummer Night's Dream is popular with theater audiences all over the world, but unpopular as a rule with the more philosophical critics. They like the poetry of rural England, but they dislike the love of rhetoric, which they declare artificial. They look in vain for intellectual and spiritual nourishment. George Orwell observed that this most actable play is one of the least admired in the theater of Shakespeare, and he obviously found nothing admirable in it. The tradition behind this disdain goes back very far into the past. After attending a performance of the play, Samuel Pepys commented in his diary that it is the most insipid and ridiculous play that I ever saw in my life. So that is kind of the critical view of this play is like, it's fun for kind of the masses, but serious Shakespeare scholars prefer Hamlet or Julius Caesar or what have you.
And I would say this, I wouldn't say that like it's thin, because I think there's a lot of that you can read into it as far as obviously love, I guess, and sort of that element, but sort of there's a dynamic between gender in this play that I think if I was to read it now and try to do like a, in my college studies, like what angle would I take? I think I might look into that angle. But purely structural sense, it's very, I don't know. It just felt, doesn't really come together for me, I guess, in a way. Like all the sort of elements to it are interesting, I think, in a part. Sometimes they don't feel like they're all from the same play. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it is kind of all over. There's the four lovers.
Yes.
Demetrius, Lysander, Helena, and Hermia. Mm-hmm. The forest fairy creatures, Puck, Titania, Oberon. Mm-hmm. And what, the parent, the king, queen of Athens,
yes,
about to get married, and the actors, the silly kind of Bottom and the woodsman and all the actors who are going to put on the play, Pyramus and Thisbe. Play within a play is something that Shakespeare likes to do. Mm-hmm. It's in Hamlet too. Hamlet and Midsummer Night's Dream all have plays within play.
So yeah, all those elements, through various aspects of various times during the play, those are interesting. But for some reason, the structure for this time when I read it was like, especially the ending, I was like, I don't know. It just left me like, not what's the point, but like, this is how it is. Like, this is
silly. Maybe in a different mood, you would have kind of maybe enjoyed it more.
Yeah.
But still maybe not seen.
I think I kind of hold the opinion that I think the ending is not great. Okay. Is that a terrible take? Maybe. I don't know.
No, that's fine. You, George Orwell and Samuel Pepys.
Me and, you know, yeah, Samuel Pepys. But I was like, I don't know why we end there with this. I don't know. It feels very strange. I don't know if I saw it performed live, I would feel differently. If maybe a question I had for you is, how do you view Puck? Like, how is...
Well, after read before, I thought he was just a trickster and one of the more fun characters in the play. Now, I think he is the personification, the anthropomorphization of mimetic desire.
Okay.
Do you want me to run you through kind of Gerard's main points here?
Yeah, let's get it, because you've done the groundwork for some.
It's a foothold. It's something. It's fun. I don't know that I agree with
everything. Bounce some theories off me. I'm ready. Okay. Bounce some theories.
So remember in Red and the Black, Gerard's take on that was Julian Sorrell was kind of an empty vessel as far as desire, and he had no mooring, no tradition as to who to be in the world, and he got all his desires from wanting to be great like Napoleon. But it was a vague notion, and it kind of that ultimately led him to disaster because his desire was from external points. So Gerard has that same theory about this is kind of what a Midsummer Night's Dream about. So I guess the first leg of that would be to realize how similar the four lovers, Demetrius, Lysander, Helen, and Hermia, how similar they all are. So his theory, and which I agree with, I'll start talking like that. The theory is the four lovers are all remarkably similar. They're the two dudes are very handsome. The two women are pretty. I've seen some movie versions where Helena's kind of frazzled and like less attractive than Hermia, the one that both boys like. But I think that's right. In a good working of this play, they're all almost look the same. They're all good looking. They're all just as attractive. And each of them wants the other one, whichever one they're attracted to, it's when the opposite doesn't want them. Yeah. So if you pay attention to the play, that's always the case, you know, and as the play goes on, it's because Puck put something in their eyes, which is also a hint. You know, you desire what you see with your eyes, and Puck puts the potion in their eyes. But if you'll notice, whenever, because it all shifts too, they all like each other at different times. It always changes, and it's the lover always wants the person who doesn't want them, and it always shifts. But that's always, so it's wanting what you don't have, basically.
Oh yeah, I think it's a lot. You find in the play a lot of this superficial, the right word. Just sort of the notion of love is very.
The rhetoric is superficial. I think that rubs a lot of people the wrong way.
Okay.
And it kind of did me my first reading. Right. Mm-hmm. And it actually really bugs me in Romeo and Juliet. That's like my least favorite Shakespeare play, because it just, the airy fairy lovey dovey stuff really grates on my nerves.
Yeah.
But once you kind of see it through this lens, like the characters don't even really mean it. They don't listen to each other when they talk. They don't even really listen to themselves. They're kind of just like Julian Sorrell in love with the notion of being in love. So they're caught up. They are caught up in their heads. They want a storybook romance from the myths and legends.
Well, I think a good point of that is when they start to like Helena, she kind of thinks they're making.
She assumes it's
joking. They're like joking and like making fun of her. And that to me was, the kind of the idea of you want something, but even if you got it, you would distrust the motives behind it. So it's an unattainable thing, right?
And Helena would also be in love with the notion of being in love with something unobtainable, right? Yes. So Lysander turns around and says, "Oh, I love you." And she's like, "Why do you mock me?" Mm-hmm. Because she doesn't really want Lysander. She wants to be the victim of unrequited love.
Yeah.
And moving on to the next leg of this,
the
play kind of starts out with Lysander and Helena asking to be wed, and then Helena's father insisting that Helena marry Demetrius, right? And so it's set up to be kind of your classic, the parental authority, the king and the girl's father are forbidding true love to blossom. And so the lovers are going to get together and run away. That's the setup. And Gerard insists that is kind of a satire. It's meant to kind of be a parental authority in this play. He insists is kind of like a paper tiger, like it's there, but it's really there more for the kids, the lovers, to rebel against.
I like
that. They like the fact that their father is forbidding it, because that gives them the storied role to play.
I like this because it leads you down the path of, I think it really Shakespeare, the four lovers are not scorned, but that's not where his true self is in this story. Like, I don't think it's kind of for the audience, I guess. And maybe I saw somewhere where they thought Shakespeare's point of view were with the kind of like actors performing the play in some way. But that's interesting because it's all.
Well,
you want to be like a bad boy, but if there's nothing to rebel against, or if there's nothing to the rules of, or you defy conventions, then you're really, what do you identify yourself as?
You need, exactly. So that's the, so you, they need the father's disapproval to enact their story. The affair loses its zest without that. It's kind of crazy because I read all the Gerard stuff, then I read the play again and watched the movie, and it kind of clicked. I was like, oh my God, maybe I'm just biased, but it was like, oh, this is, you see it. Once you know to look for it, you're like, holy cow, this is it. How did everybody miss this? It's totally. And then, you know, Hermia wants to be chased and admired. And that's why she fell out of love with Demetrius. It's hinted that she was with Demetrius before. She's in love with Lysander, and Demetrius is still in love with Hermia. And that's why she's no longer interested in Demetrius, because Demetrius is after her and she doesn't want that. Lysander's forbidden now. And so that's the exciting thing. And that'll shift later in the play once Puck pours the potion in his eyes. Demetrius no longer wants Hermia, she wants Helena. All of a sudden, Hermia is interested in Lysander. It's a complicated dynamics, and I know if the listener hasn't read the play, it might sound confusing. Well, but trust me, it's meant to be confusing, but when you break down, knowing all this, and you break down like the when each character is into the other one, you're like, holy cow, yeah, it all follows this pattern. It's too intricate, and it pans out way too clearly for it to be an accident. Like, Shakespeare is obviously doing this on purpose.
Is he mocking them in a way? Is there an alternative in the play of like, this is actually quote unquote ideal love, where it's more pragmatic and not.
He's satirizing. So it would be the notion, it's very popular in theater. Gerard paints it back to the Greeks, like, you know, Western theater, where it was always a conceit, especially in the romances, that the young lovers are forbidden by parental authority to proceed with their love. And that's, you know, the concept of the play, what gives it its grit. It's, you know, it's in romantic comedies. It's in every, you know, youth's love is forbidden. And I think this is a satire of that notion. Okay. So he's kind of satirizing.
I agree with that, actually.
He's satirizing theater, you know, the traditions of drama, But he also kind of makes it a fun and entertaining, if you wish to see it that way, it's kind of a fun, entertaining, you know, play about love. But if you dig a little deeper, he's kind of making fun of the very concept of it. It's pretty clever.
I think,
you know,
I like the way he handles the four lovers and sort of the, like how Puck messes up. I think, I kind of agree. I think it highlights sort of their, it's almost like Puck is, or sort of like how they, like, next person you look upon is the person you love. It almost feels like actually this is, could be reality without the potion, I guess, in a way, if circumstances were changed in real life,
and that's,
you would just switch your love or allegiance to fit the role that you choose to lit, like you want to be the
subconsciously too.
Yes. Yeah.
You don't admit that to yourself.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, but when you lose interest in somebody, if you like to be chased, you lose interest in somebody when they no longer, or, you know, it's no longer a chase, then you like move on to something else.
Yeah. And I like when they finally, like, they kind of, they've screwed it up. They get the wrong people in love or whatever, and then they kind of, like, you know, untie the knot, so to speak, and then it's just sort of like, oh, was this all a dream? Or because this was something I wanted to talk to, and I have a feeling you have, like, there might be a theory about it or whatever, but I saw someone say, and I can't remember off the top, that the play should work if it's all just a dream, like the whole thing is a dream.
Yeah.
And that was their criticism of it. And I was like, I don't know how to take, like, the dream aspect of the play.
I think it's supposed to be, it's dreamlike. It's kind of,
yeah,
I don't think it is. I think it's meant to be kind of, this actually happens. The supernatural creatures and Puck are personifications of the mental, the psychological processes, mm-hmm. that, you know, this goes, that the people go through.
Any more? So what are some other,
well, so with the flimsiness, the flimsiness of parental authority, I thought was really key to understanding the whole thing. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes sense. And in fact, the father, because it's hinted that Hermia and Demetrius were together before Hermia really wanted to be with Lysander. So the whole reason the father would be so strict and forbidding of Hermia to marry Lysander would be because he'd already given his permission for her to marry Demetrius.
Okay.
So it's subtly hinted he's not even being just arbitrary. He's like, he already gave his word that for the other two to be wed.
Now he's trying to
go back on it. And he's just saying no, because he's got his pride and he doesn't want to be made a fool of. I thought that was interesting. And it's, yeah, that is kind of hinted at in the book. So the structure, it's kind of the parental authority being a paper tiger, and every obstacle in the way of the lovers getting their desires resides within. That's kind of the crux of Gerard's thing. And that actually really makes sense.
Is it? I think that reading or whatever, it gets support by the fact that their story is not the only story in the play. Like, it's not, I would say it's like the focus of the play, but it's smashed in between, sort of, to me, not very well connected. Like I admit I don't know the backstory between, like, of the play that they're performing. I have a feeling that like,
You're missing Thisbe.
Yeah. So that it's like described, but like, I'm not familiar with that. So that's a blind spot on I'm positive that has a very deeper meaning, well, like the whole structure and meaning of play.
Well,
go ahead.
It's interesting. It's remarkably similar to Romeo and Juliet.
Okay.
Right. Or Shakespeare obviously took aspects of Romeo and Juliet from Pyramus and Thisbe. Right. It's about two forbidden lovers, which is, again, key. Lovers forbidden to be wed. They decide to go meet in the woods somewhere. And the guy, I think Pyramus, goes into the woods, meets a lion, kills the lion. He's all bloody. And there's some misunderstanding. And Thisbe goes and sees a bloody Pyramus, assumes she's dead, and she kills herself. much like Romeo and Juliet. There's a, they're both alive, but one kills himself because they think the other's dead. Right. So there's a remarkable similarity to Romeo and Juliet. Side note, do you remember if Pyramus and Thisbe plays a big or a small role in Count of Monte Cristo? That was Maximilian and the Villefort's daughter. They always reference Pyramus and Thisbe because they talk to each other through a wall.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Thing. So that's in.
Oh, interesting.
But the Pyramus, and it's significant that the actors are going to put on the play Pyramus and Thisbe.
Not a very.
Play about a genuine play where the parental authority is real. It's about young lovers in a forbidden romance. So it's significant that that's the play the actors are putting on.
What I felt like it was, it's not an appropriate play for a wedding though, right? Like crazy.
I think they're just expected to put on a play.
Okay. And they're not very, okay. Okay.
Well, they're fun. I think there's some stuff with the actors too. One thing that I noticed on my own.
There we go. I like this. Okay.
You want me to do it?
Yeah, I'm ready.
This one, there's lots of mimetic stuff with the actors and everything and how they see themselves and blah, blah, blah. But what I noticed, there was a part where before Bottom gets translated or transmuted into a donkey, they're talking about how they're going to put on the play. And it's for the king and queen at their at their wedding. And they're assuming, like, we're going to be so good in this role because there's a lion. He's like, they're obviously the ladies, the noble ladies are going to be afraid because we're going to pull it off so well. And the lion's going to be so realistic. We should have a little warning sign. We should have a little monologue that will add that says, we are mere actors and this is not a real lion. And there is some sword play in the play. And like, obviously the noble ladies will be afraid of this. So we should have a little note saying, we are but mere actors and no one is harmed in this. I thought that was hilarious. It's kind of glossed over, but he's kind of poking fun at actors. It was- Well, and you know, bad actors, putting on, watering down and kind of ruining the play by patronizing their audience.
Well, it's,
you know what I mean? That was a funny, that was a really funny.
So you can almost say then that they know that they're bad and then the mere fact that they get-
No, they don't know they're bad. They take themselves so seriously. They think everyone's going to be afraid. They're going to be so good at the sword play and the lion's going to be so convincing that everyone's going to be afraid that it's real.
Yeah.
And first of all, there's no danger of that because everybody at the wedding knows it's a play. They're buffoons. So no one's, it's just so many different things. There's like, but they think so highly of themselves, they don't see the reality of the situation, which is people know what a play is. It's going to be fine. It's obviously a person with a crude lion's head on their, you know, it's, I thought it was really funny when pretentious actors talk down to the audience.
No, but
here's kind of what happens.
I have a little bit of a slightly different take because I felt bad for them in a way. Because I thought the like mean criticism of them at the very end, like I took it as like, this is kind of, you know, who are these lovers to judge these quote unquote terrible actors? I don't know. I felt they were the people that were actually going to actually entertain the audience, maybe, because it's hard to describe because it's a play within a play. So, but it is the play. So are they supposed to be the most enjoyable aspect of the play? I think you could argue that they are, right?
Or well, no? They're being, at the end, they're taking themselves seriously, but they're so bad at it. Everyone assumes it's a comedy.
Yeah, but right? Yes, but like, Shakespeare has made them that way so that there can be enjoyment from them, right?
Character. Yeah.
I'm getting in my own head here.
I don't know if we disagree. They're well-drawn characters. I think, and they're meant to be funnier than the movie version I watched. I really like the movie
version. Did you watch the 1999 version?
Yeah, okay. I like that. I was well cast. I like the 1890s Italy. There's some bicycles. I like the feel. It was a good version, but they kind of gloss over that. I thought I was proud of myself for noticing that. So that's hilarious. This is going to be so good. We need to write our own little warning that it's not a real lion. There's some parallels there too. Can you think of any sort of modern authors or movies that talk down to the audience. So people are so stupid, they're going to think this is real. So we need to just dumb it down for them so they don't actually go out. It's like, we all know what a movie is.
But see, I think
no one's going to.
Don't you feel like the four lovers take themselves way too seriously?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's not picking sides. Peter, he.
I'm picking sides.
The actors are meant to be kind of like a comic relief. And he's satirizing the conventions of theater. He's kind of pointing out something in human nature, I think, with the four lovers and how their desires bounce back and forth. You know, I don't know. It's fascinating.
I have a theory. Do you wish this play was longer?
Yeah, I kind of
wish it was longer.
Mm. Yeah,
and I don't know exactly why, but I feel like there's a couple beats that are off. And I don't know. I just wish.
You think you want more explanation? Like more explicit connections between everything?
No, I don't need that. The play just needs to marinate for a second. And it kind of just goes fairly quickly through the beats. I like I said, this is my amateur viewing of the play, but I just thought, let's just pause here. Let's not end their night of dreaming or.
Like you wanted more.
I wanted more, maybe. I'm a play that I'm lukewarm on, I think. All right, Matt, let's get back into your theories.
No, so I mean that's the big parts of it.
Okay.
And I guess the play was originally written to be put on for a wedding in the court, someone's wedding in the court of Queen Elizabeth in like 1595, 1596-ish. Yeah. So it was going to be put on for the nobility, which is also kind of mirrored in the play itself. These actors are putting on a play for a royal wedding, right? But, and Gerard says this, so the kind of level, the two levels, he wanted it to be a fun play for the masses, for most people. You could view it as, you know, a fun romance with, you know, the fairy realm and all that stuff. The basic conception what it is for most people today. But he also said there's going to be lots of kind of sharper people there who are expecting him to live up to his reputation as the best playwright in England. And so the subtler stuff was for them. And so because it was written for that sort of audience, he had it multi-tiered. I think he pulled it off pretty well.
I don't dislike the play. I have some issues with it. I'm glad that me and Samuel Pepys,
But if you ever watch a version of it again, keep this stuff in mind. I can give you a little refresher. It's fascinating because he really is on something. It really does kind of pan out that way.
And like I said in the beginning, I probably read this not, you know, without, you know, not 100%. Mental focus, and that was on me. Maybe I don't know. I wasn't distracted, but you know, just doing a lot of other stuff and get the Shakespeare in, and getting a little annoyed. Like, why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? But I know he's smarter than me.
But that's how I read it too. I wouldn't have seen this stuff without the book putting it away. You know what I mean? But it is kind of cool once you see it.
Anyway, so yeah. No, I. Reading the, even though you missed stuff, even though I couldn't understand my notes from 15 years ago, where I was like, what? I do recommend, if there's any listeners who are going into college and they're interested in English, to take a Shakespeare class, because a good Shakespeare teacher, I remember that class just being like floored by everything, like just how they can explain it. And one of the issues I sort of have, or something to get used to, is just like reading Shakespeare with like footnotes. Like, how do you just read through it, and then like when you don't understand something, because sometimes there's no way of understanding like what a phrase actually means. You think you know, but it's actually, oh, it's completely,
you gotta look it up. yeah
So there is that element to it. Because sometimes you're like, oh, I understand that part, the whole section, I get it. And then you look at the footnotes, you're like, oh, I misread that and I misread that. So you're like, oh, crap. So, but not just footnotes. That the teacher I had went into more like the subtlety to it all, what Shakespeare alludes to. And if you take one of those classes, I think you'll realize just sort of how brilliant the plays are and kind of.
I mean, there's a reason he's still around. There is, it's fun. You can kind of fall into the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
The language can be kind of daunting at first, but you do kind of fall it. Once you get into it, you kind of follow along.
There must be a Norton critical edition of like all the plays, right? Am I crazy? That should be a thing that exists. Let me look this up.
I don't know. Sometimes, like my version didn't have any extra stuff. I had to go out and find the Girard essays. But you'd be fine with it just on its own.
Oh, yeah.
There's the No Fear Shakespeare. I remember a lot of high school kids buy that, you know.
Is that where they just...
Heavily, heavily annotated.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole scenes are broken up into plain English. And actually, if you Google any of Shakespeare's plays, the top three or four results are going to be stuff clearly broken down for high school kids. It's like the Cliff Notes, the No Fear, all this other stuff, you know.
See, I don't like that as much, but just bringing up or critical essays or just maybe like a historical background of what the audience would know, that you as a modern reader just certainly you don't have any of that, like,
yeah,
reference really.
Well, I was annoyed by it because I was trying to find George Orwell's essay on Midsummer Night's Dream, and I kept searching it, and all that would come up was like high school breakdowns of Midsummer Night's Dream. So I don't need, but whatever.
You can't, there is, I'm looking right now, you can't get, I think there's a expensive one with sort of a good portion of the plays, but you can't get individual ones of Norton critical editions of Midsummer Night's Dream, Romeo and Juliet, so on and so forth. So they are out there. So
let me just say, with Shakespeare, watching the movie or like video recordings of the play doesn't count as cheating. If you're a college or high school student, that they were meant to be performed. Just make sure the movie is accurate. You don't want to, sometimes they edit or cut stuff or rearrange it. So if you're watching it for class, that's fine. Don't necessarily tell the teacher, but make sure the movie version is syncs up with the play.
And you can kind of tell within the first 5-10 minutes if it's going to be like that. Yeah. My opinion, but I don't know. So yeah. Hopefully people don't think I'm an idiot now that I've kind
of. No. I think you're in line with, and it's a perfectly fine, you know, aesthetic preference. You're a Hamlet guy more than a Midsummer Night's Dream guy. I hope I was kind of, there's a lot more of the Girard stuff we have to get into. It goes into, he goes like really in depth. We don't have to do it there, but I hope it kind of helps. Like it's fascinating. Just watch for that. If you go out and read it after listening to this,
I was vaguely aware of that. So when you mentioned it as like, okay, I can see it because it felt very, how Shakespeare changes their like, person that they love or the interest and all that, and that felt a lot of like
it's meant to be satirical.
Yes and
I actually think Girard's got his whole worldview that's bigger than just Shakespeare. He goes into he sees all his little mimetic theory and Shakespeare, Stendhal, Flaubert, Proust, Joyce, all these people, and I think he's onto something. But later in his life, he had this whole big worldview of mimetic conflict is where myth itself stems from. And so like Oedipus, there was a real life Oedipus. And rather than the historical Oedipus didn't actually kill his father and sleep with his mother, he happened to be king during times of famine. And that led to a bunch of violence and mimetic stuff going on with the population. And the king was sacrificed. He's a sacrificial victim. All mimetic crises sacrifices lead to a sort of ritualistic sacrifice. And then the myth that sprung from that, they would have added later that Oedipus deserved it because he did all these, killed his father, his mother. So this is the basic gist. He thinks all this, and he kind of went into that a little bit in A Midsummer Night's Dream. And he had this whole theory about how, because Lysander and Demetrius almost fight, but Puck kind of draws them off. And he's saying this was a comedy, so Shakespeare couldn't, you know, go as far. He also, there's certain parts where he says Shakespeare hasn't matured enough to basically grasp Rene Girard's theory, which I thought was kind of funny. It's like, slow down. You're interpreting Shakespeare fun, but like he's a French guy. So like a stereotypical Shakespeare hadn't matured to kind of see the world the way I do. So that was kind of, but I think actually he's really onto something. It's a very useful foothold into this stuff, Rene Girard. But I actually think Shakespeare's having more fun in this than Girard's. Like, he's poking fun at actors at the theater. He's writing a play for a wedding in Queen Elizabeth's court, and he's got a play within a play about actors putting on a play for the king and queen of Athens's court, and the actors are buffoons, and the lovers think they're in love, but they're their own worst enemies. It's fun, and I think there's more to it. There's more substance to it than a silly fun play, but I think it's a brilliant little play.
I think I agree with you on all those points. For me personally, it's just not a play I can love.
Fair enough.
I don't know. There's not some element where I care deeply about that I'm like, oh, I love this aspect of it. I think I appreciate everything that you kind of just listed there and like, okay, I agree with that. But I don't know. For me, it's just not, nothing stirs in me with the play. And I know that like comedies probably aren't supposed to do that, but.
Hey, there's no accounting for taste. That's okay.
I'm gonna say a dumb comment right now, but I'm gonna say it anyway. A Midsummer Night's Dream is a fantastic name for a play.
Yeah, isn't it?
It's an all-time great title for a play, don't you think? Mm-hmm. It evokes a lot in my mind. Not just, it's like, oh, of course there's fairies. Of course.
Yeah. It's a perfect,
it's a great name.
Okay. It's a perfect book to read in the summer, play to put on in the summer. We picked it for our July book of the month.
It's November.
Yeah, November. But that's fine.
Hey, we read it.
We actually read it.
We'll come back to Shakespeare eventually.
We should. Actually, maybe we'll get into that later. Maybe soon here.
Oh.
I want to get this in before we end. So let's say they're going to do an updated, like what, like the latest movie version was Italy in like the 1890s. Do you have any ideas would it work in an updated setting, or where would you set this? Because I think you could shift it around to be anywhere in time or wherever.
How about this? I was kind of thinking about this, but I didn't come to a conclusion, but what if you did it on kind of like the upper crust of like Northeast United States, like New England, Martha's Vineyard or something like that?
Yeah.
Where it's just, there's an element of, I think you could play into the fact that the four lovers don't really know what they want, and what they want is something that they can't have, and that's their identity. And that's a criticism of them and their sort of wealth, I guess. And sort of the.
Yeah, make it. Yeah.
I think there's some way you can tie into it. Yeah. Like there's a class to this too. There's elements of class in this play.
If you notice, even the actors, they don't speak in the same. Pentameter, whatever the typical poetic rhythm in Shakespeare, the actors don't speak like that. I bet in most plays they have a Cockney accent. This British upper crust one. So yeah, you could. That's better than my idea.
Okay.
But I like the New England upper crust, New England people in like boat shoes and sweaters around their necks and playing tennis,
who take themselves seriously and all their.
And then you'd really play it up. You'd have the two actors, almost the Lysander and Demetrius, would look almost identical. They're just both really handsome. The two, Hermia and Helena, look really both like really pretty blonde or whatever, like just almost exactly alike, and you'd really play up the Girardian aspect of it.
Make it really, I don't know how you adapt for this, like the fairies and sort of I don't know.
Do you have them be actual super? Because there's woods up there.
You could have them actually. You could
have them kind of get drunk or take some mushrooms or something and go out into the woods. But no, because the people don't even really see the fairies. You could just have.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know. Do you have the fairies be real or? I don't know, but I think you could do it. And then you'd have the actors be really pretentious college kids doing summer theater. And you'd play up there. This is going to be too real. We have to have a little warning for people to know. This is not a real lion.
But
you
can
have fun with that.
You have that, but almost like they don't come from money. They are sort of the entertainment for these.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's my theory. That's
yeah, and there'd be a big, it'd be a big political wedding. It'd yes, the governor's getting married or whatever.
Old money getting married.
I like that. Okay. That's good. That's better. My idea, at first I thought it'd be good in like the South in the 30s or 40s.
Okay,
I can like see you that. Know really. And then I was thinking it could take place in a restaurant, like a Chili's or something, and it's all the wait staff. And the fairies and whatnot are stoners out in the parking lot.
That is actually pretty. I like that. I don't know if that's good Chili's, but yeah.
Dining. You'd have to call it Pepito's or some other, you know. Everybody knows it's Chili's or Applebee's, but yeah. But I like the New England one's perfect. That's good.
It's a double date at Chili's?
Yeah. No, it's the waiters. Waiters and waitresses.
Okay.
Get married. And there's a bunch of weirdo stoner homeless people in the parking lot. And that's your, yeah.
I like that. I like that a lot. Okay. That's Shakespeare for A Midsummer Night's Dream. So we have got that under our belt after over 100 episodes. We've done Shakespeare, man. Proud of us?
I'm proud of myself.
Proud of yourself. I like you did. You did it. That's some good context to the play you brought.
Yeah,
people are gonna like that.
It tracks.
I think I'm shallow maybe, but
no, you and Orwell is like you and everybody.
Hey, there you go. We have a variety of books on our TBR that are kind of a hodgepodge of different genres and different, you know, some serious stuff, some fun horror stuff. So I'm just going to read through some of the stuff we have coming up on our TBR. The last thing we picked was Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, if you remember that from your childhood, with the caveat that you have to read the book in a scary place in your house, alone, preferably in the dark, with a, you know, book light or something like that. So that's coming up. We have Drive Your Plow, Over the Bones of the Dead, and we have The Master and Margarita. We have Eight Men Out, which I'm almost done with, and Lions of Lucerne over on our Patreon coming up. And some of our longer works that we're going to be working through is Life and Fate and The Once and Future King. Eight Men Out might be my surprise of the year. I'm just going to say that.
It's fun. I finished it. Okay. It's good. It's fascinating. There's a ton of stuff there.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of parallels. It should be a fun episode on
gambling. I don't even think you have to be like a fan of baseball, really. If you're a fan of history and baseball, this book is a must read. It is so good. It's so fascinating. So I think that might be the book we're kind of looking forward to talking about. Maybe we'll be talking about that next. Who knows?
I think it'll be here soon.
But it's a great, great book. And if you just, like, I think both of us had just sort of heard the story before and just sort of assumed what was going on. But there's a lot more.
It's deeper than you think. It raises some interesting questions about what's going on now. Mm-hmm.
So
I started thinking of, like, how could they have gotten away with, like, it was just kind of a bungled Oh, it's like watching a heist movie. It's like, oh, you could have gotten away with it had you just done this, but every step of the way they screw it up. It's fascinating.
Crazy how many people knew about this.
Yeah. It's like, why are you doing this?
We were like, how many people know about this thing? And it's just like, oh yeah, everyone.
Open secret. They got prosecuted 2 years later.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Yeah. So I think that's over on Patreon. So if you want to support us over there, you'll hear episodes that we'll put out, talk about books. We have Thriller Book Club over there. So we do sports stuff over there. So support us over there. Matt, did I miss any books that we have coming up?
I think we'll try to get 8 Men out and maybe Scary Stories Tell in the Dark halfway soon.
Oh yeah.
Just halfway thematical.
Like top, yeah. I'm curious to see how you like Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead, which sounds like a metal band. Actually, I don't want
it's funnier to than I thought. I see where it's going, but I like it. I like the narrator.
It's an odd, but I think
quirky in a good way.
Quirky.
It's not like heavy Slavic, what I was worried about, just being just a bummer. It's actually quirky and kind of funny. So
it's a unique book too, I think. So excited to talk about that book. So as always, get in contact with us over on our social media, Twitter, Instagram, all that kind of fun stuff. Let us know what you're reading. Let us know what you thought of our opinions on Midsummer Night's Dream.
And the questionnaire, if you have any questions for the questionnaire, because we're going to
And would you it out. Live in a railroad car?
Yeah.
Fix it up. Make it nice. So until next time, we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.